Charudas here, welcoming you to another study session in Bhagavad Gita as it is. Today's verse is the 47th verse in the second chapter. The second chapter is entitled Contents of the Gita Summarized. This is a very important verse. I'll read the Sanskrit and then I'll read the English. Karmani vadikaraste mafalashu kadajana makarma falahitubur mate sangustua karmani. Translation, you have a right to perform your prescribed duty, but you are not entitled to the fruits of action. Never consider yourself the cause of the results of your activities, and never be attached to not doing your duty. Commentary in just a moment. In the last lesson, if you happen to have been listening, you'll recall how we compared Krishna consciousness to the flowing river which never becomes contaminated. The reason we were able to do this is because of the liberal, universal nature of Krishna consciousness. If you have a river flowing through a village, if the course of the river is diverted and all of a sudden it flows through the village, that river will overflood all the individual wells. Similarly, from the platform of chanting the holy names of the Lord, all other religious processes can automatically be understood. One can understand Buddhism, what he was trying to teach. One can understand Lord Jesus Christ. One time, my spiritual master gave a lecture at St. Paschal's Seminary in Melbourne, Australia. This was a seminary for religious students. And at the end of his talk, he was asked to comment on St. Francis. By Srila Prabhupada's comments on St. Francis, many of the seminarian students there were crying. Tears were forced down their cheeks by the words of appreciation that our spiritual master had for St. Francis. And one seminarian said that, "I think that although you're coming from what we consider as a different religious tradition, you have an even better appreciation of our own saints than we do." This illustrates the point that if one is Krishna consciousness, if Krishna is known, who is the cause of all causes, then everything else becomes known and nothing remains unknown. Krishna consciousness is the most magnanimous religious process. It wasn't created in order to protect a religious system which was dying or being debilitated. It wasn't created as a buffer or a cushion against some alien influence. It is the original culture of the spiritual world. As I mentioned in the last class, if you can imagine what's going on in the kingdom of God, it is mainly that all the inhabitants there are glorifying the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, there are different ways of glorifying Him. You can glorify someone by your work, by working for that person's satisfaction. You can glorify a person by taking care of their needs and their necessities. You can glorify a person by chanting their name and singing their glories. Service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead begins with the chanting of His holy name. Sevan Mukhi Jivado. We've got a tongue. We've got different senses. There's the nose, the eyes, the ears, the sense of touch. There's the mind, and then there's the tongue. And of all the senses, the tongue is the most voracious and difficult to control. Just like sometimes when you have to heed nature's call, you have to go to the bathroom. You can't put it off. You have to go. Similarly, the urgings of the tongue are so strong that, practically speaking, no one can resist them. You ever had that feeling you're sitting at home and all of a sudden you want to eat some chocolate or you want a pizza? So you put everything else aside, even if you're doing some important work, doing the end of the month bill paying, doing your accounts, whatever it is, your tongue will drag you out of the house, into your car, half a mile, mile, 2 miles, 5 miles, maybe even 10 miles, to a place that serves the type of food that you like. Our spiritual master used to talk about one restaurant in Japan that served some type of birds, some little types of birds who were considered delicacy. And you couldn't get them in most of the restaurants. So So people would drive out of Tokyo 50 miles just to eat these fried birds. This is the strength of the uncontrolled tongue. And just as the tongue will not be denied when it wants to eat a particular delicate type of foodstuff, neither will it be denied when it wants to talk some gossip or some nonsense. You see how little control people have over their tongues. They will talk anything and anything. It is said that a rumor is compared to a wildfire in dry grass. If you have dry grass and you touch a match, then immediately that flame will spread all over the field. Similarly, people will repeat anything and everything they hear, whether it's nonsense or whether it is not. So of all the senses, the tongue is the most voracious and difficult to control. Therefore, service to God begins with the tongue. If one can take a vow that I will eat only vegetarian foods which have been offered to Krishna, and I'll not talk and repeat any nonsense that comes into my ear, I'll take a vow that any nonsense that comes into my ear will not come out of my mouth. I will talk only about Krishna, Krishna consciousness, Krishna's devotees, spreading the Krishna consciousness movement. This is the beginning of service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. When one takes this vow and follows it, he becomes a Brahmin. You've heard the term Brahmin. You might have read about it in history books. And you've probably come to think of a Brahmin as someone who was born in a certain family or a certain caste in India. And artificially he's taken advantage of his high birth and acting like a parasite in society. This is the way it is to some degree nowadays in India, where Brahmanism is determined by birth. Originally, it was not determined by birth. It was determined by qualities and characteristics. And it didn't matter what type of a family a person was born in, if he showed a liberalism of heart, a magnanimity, if he showed compassion, if he showed learning and he was willing to disseminate that learning, if he showed purity of character, because if you're going to teach, you have to teach by what you are as much as by what you say. Samo dhammo tapaso cham santim arjavam eva cha. The qualifications of a Brahmin are given in the 18th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Samo dhammo, he must be able to control his mind. He must be able to control his senses, the foremost of which is the tongue. Tapas, he must be austere. Not that he gets a big salary for teaching. Not that he goes on strike for a higher wage, which is calculated according to the index of the cost of living. He's austere. He lives simply. Depends only on the charitable donations that he gets from the parents of his students. Tapasocham, he's very clean. He showers two or three times a day for external cleanliness, and internally he chants the holy name of the Lord for cleansing the heart. A Brahmin is, over and above everything else, liberal and magnanimous. He gives of himself to society. On the other hand, a miserly person, kripana falahetava, kripana, miser, he's always looking for the fruits. He's saying, what's in it for me? What am I going to get out of this? If he doesn't see any benefit to himself in doing a particular activity, he won't do it. He'll find some excuse, he has something else to do, he doesn't have time or whatever. Unless he can see some return to himself, either in the form of money or prestige, he will not embark upon a particular field or course of endeavor. On the other hand, the Brahmin, his whole life is styled towards helping others out. He doesn't even calculate what's in it for me. He thinks, what's in it for other people? What benefit can I do to other people? And the truly Brahminical activity, the highest welfare work for the Brahmin, is to propagate the chanting of the holy names of the Lord. This is real liberalism. This is real welfare work. The miserly man, he produces a little loaf of bread and some cheese and dal and chapatis on the table, and he's so proud that by the sweat of my brow, I have produced this bread. This is my bread. No one else can come to take my bread. And this is my house, my family, my country. He thinks that whatever he's got, that has come to him as a result of his own work, that is his just deserts and just reward. On the other hand, a Brahmin is one who prays to God, my dear Father who art in heaven, you're already taking care of me, you've already anticipated all of my needs. Even before I was born into this world, you filled my mother's breast with milk. So if you protected me and provided for me while I was in the womb of my mother, why should I be in anxiety that you will not protect or provide for me now? And a Brahminical person, he has no concern about his maintenance, he has no bank balance. If in the morning someone gives him a donation for spreading Krishna consciousness, he will have spent it in the evening, and the next day he will be penniless. The Brahmin looks around in nature, he sees the birds and the bees. They don't stock up food for the future. They don't put money in their bank balance. They trust in God. Every animal wakes up every morning with nothing, no food, no nothing, confident that God will provide for him in the upcoming day. And it is true. God does provide for them. If God provides for the animals, those who are less than human, those who haven't got the capacity in this birth for God consciousness, then how much more is he going to provide for those who are glorifying him, for those who are dedicated to his devotional service? I think it's Solomon. In the Songs of Solomon, you find the verse, "Consider the lilies of the field, they give no thought for the morrow, yet they are arrayed in more glory than Solomon in all of his splendor." This is the history of Vaishnavas. This is the history, if you read the life stories, the biographies of our great Vaishnavacharyas who lived 400 or 500 years ago, you'll find that they didn't lift a finger for their maintenance, and yet their maintenance was amply provided for. There's the story of Raghunath Das Goswami. Raghunath Das was somewhat of an avaduta, or Sanatan Goswami. He was somewhat of an avaduta. He would become so much absorbed in love of Godhead that oftentimes he would forget his external circumstances and surroundings. And there was danger of him doing himself bodily harm just because of his obliviousness to the phenomenal world. One time Raghunath Das Goswami was sitting right in the middle of the hot sun. You've heard the term, only mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the noonday sun of India. So anyone in his right mind would never venture out and sit underneath the sun in the hardest part of the day. He's courting sunstroke and death. But Sanatana on this particular day was so much absorbed in chanting the holy name of the Lord, so much absorbed internally that he forget that his external body was exposed to the most excruciatingly warm, suffocating rays of the sun. So his brother Rupa happened along as Sanatan was chanting right in the middle of the sun rays, and Rupa Goswami saw that standing over Sanatan Goswami, holding a part of her sari over his head in order to provide some shade for him, was none other than Srimati Radharani, the eternal consort of Sri Krishna, the personality of Godhead. We'd like to say a word or two here about the importance of sound also. Sound is the most basic element in the creation of this material world. It is said that before anything else it was the Omkar, and from the Omkar everything else came into being. You add to Omkar color, you add to Omkar property, you add to Omkar texture, you add to Omkar sight and sound, and you have the cosmic manifestation. But the seed of generation is the Omkar, or sound, and sound is all-pervading throughout the universe. Take your radio set, for instance, you turn it on, and automatically there are so many sounds that are passing through the air, and your radio station just happens to be able to receive those sound vibrations. Sound is all-pervading the universe, and spiritual sound is called Sabda Brahman, transcendental sound vibration. It's sound vibration which does not describe any of the temporary, illusory phenomenon of this material world. Sound vibration coming from the spiritual world describes those things which are eternal. And because the sound is describing an entity which is eternal, there's no difference between the sound and the entity itself. The sound is the thing. The thing is non-different from the sound. You can't say that about this material world. You can say tree. But that thing which you call a tree will not always be a tree. In 50 or 100 or 200 years, it will have dissolved and disappeared. So the sound, the name, the appellation and the thing are different. In the spiritual world, the appellation and the thing are non-different. So it is by sound vibration that we come directly into contact with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Sound vibrations which describe the eternal Lord and his eternal abode originate in the spiritual world, and they penetrate into this material world. And just as a sleeping person, if there's some danger, you cannot awaken that sleeping person by holding up a sign in front of him. He will not see it. We are also all sleeping in forgetfulness of God. We're just like when you sleep, you dream that you're something other than what you are. You might see yourself as a king, or you might see yourself falling over a cliff or being hunted by a tiger. Similarly, we all are oblivious in our dreamlike state to our real identity. You know, we think we're Chris Warden or Joe Smith or John Francis or Booker Washington. We think we're American or black or white, just as a dreaming man thinks of himself in terms other than what he really is. And by seeing, by holding up a sign, you'll not awaken him. You'll not startle him to reality. However, when the alarm clock rings, the sound of that alarm clock will plumb down into the depths of his consciousness and bring him up to the surface of reality. In the same way, we are eternal servants of Krishna. If you go back time immemorial, millions and millions of lifetimes, previous cosmic manifestations, if you go back to the beginning, we, each one of us, is an eternally Krishna conscious entity, and we have to revive that Krishna consciousness. I'll give you an example. Let's say you had a childhood friend when you were 4 or 5 years old. You used to play with this child all the time. His name was Philip King. But you know, you've gone on your separate ways. You've had other acquaintances, other circumstances, and you haven't forgotten Philip. The reminiscence of him is still there in a corner of your consciousness, but you don't think about him either. One day you get a phone call and the person at the other end of the line says, "This is Philip." So you don't know who Philip is. Philip who? Philip from Adam. He says, "This is Philip, Philip Cain." So gradually there begin to be the dim stirrings of recollection. The more often he repeats his name, the more the recollection of that person rises to the forefront of your consciousness. And finally you say, "Ah, Philip, right." Similarly, when we chant Hare Krishna or hear the chanting from the lips of pure devotees, the stirring of remembrance is there. And the more we chant, the more we expose ourselves to the association of devotees, the more we purify our senses by taking prasadam, vegetarian food offered in love and devotion to the Lord, the more that consciousness comes to the forefront. And when we become fixed in that consciousness, all worries and all anxieties are finished. All anxieties for maintenance, all for false prestige, everything is finished. Just like if I'm a personal friend of President Reagan, I don't have to make any independent arrangement for prestige. Because I'm the personal friend of the President of the United States, I share in all the opulences of his. Automatically, that comes along with being a friend. You live in the same house, you wear the same clothes, you drive in the same car. He'll give you money from his salary automatically. He who is a friend, he who is dependent upon the Supreme Lord or a servant of him, he has no need to make any independent arrangement for his livelihood or maintenance. He becomes a truly liberal person. He no longer has any concerns for himself, but he simply glorifies God. If there's something good which happens to him, he glorifies, "My Lord, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. I did not deserve this." If there's something bad which happens to him, he attributes that to his own karma, that in my past I've done some cruel deed and now the reaction is catching up with me. Non-devotees are just the opposite. If they get something good, like bread on the table or a good rise in salary or an appointment to a coveted position, they say, "Yes, I have done this. I deserve this. This is a result of my work. I'm number one." And if there's something miserable that happens, like a war, or they lose their job, their wife leaves them, they say, "Oh God, why have you done this?" If it's miserable, they blame God. If it's good, they take credit for themselves. The devotee is just the opposite. If it's something good, he glorifies God. If it's something bad, he blames himself. So although we're all in this world, there are millions and millions of us who have human bodies, the consciousness is different. Just like on the throne, the king is sitting and a bug is sitting, right? The king is sitting on the throne, the bug is sitting on the throne. The bug is just biting, that's all. He's biting, his only consciousness is biting and fault-finding and selfishness. And the king, he's trying to govern magnanimously the citizens. Although they're both on the throne, they have totally different consciousness. In the same way, although we're both, all of us in this material world, We all have material bodies. There's a vast difference in consciousness. Nietzsche once said that there is more difference between the consciousness of some men and other men than there is between men and the animals. And basically you can divide those two types of people into two. There are the misers, who are materialistic, who don't believe in God, who want to blame God for their problems, and whose only motivation for acting is what's in it for me. And then there are the Brahmins, or the devotees, who by virtue of their becoming fixed up at the lotus feet of their Supreme Lord, Father, and Friend, have no personal anxieties, and that leaves them all of their time to spend in performing welfare work for mankind in general.
You've been listening to commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita as it is. Bhagavad Gita is the essence of India's Vedic wisdom and one of the great spiritual and philosophical classics of the world. The ultimate conclusion of the Gita is unconditional loving surrender unto Lord Krishna, which frees one from all sins, bringing one to complete enlightenment and enables one to return to Krishna's eternal spiritual abode. Thank you.